Everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. I'm your host, Pierce Redmond, and today we are joined on the line all the way from Japan with Ryan Dawson. Ryan is a journalist, a podcaster, and a political analyst. Ryan runs the website Anti-Neocon Report, which can be found at ancreport.com, and he is also the filmmaker behind one of my favorite 9/11 truth films, which is War by Deception. And I've invited Ryan to come on the show today and talk about some of the recent goings-on in the Middle East, particularly in Iran, as well as the death of former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Well, I guess we should just get right into it. And with Iran, we've got the sanctions are still sort of ongoing in the background. We've got the sort of murmurs of some sort of a peace deal, or not peace deal, but sort of negotiation between the U.S. and Iran. And now we have Iran being invited to come and be part of the talks between the Syrian opposition and the Assad government. Ryan, in your opinion, how do you see these sort of new events right now with Iran playing out? Is there really a sort of warming of relations, or is this more of kind of the same old, same old?
Well, I like how you colored it as a deal between the U.S. and Iran, because that's basically what it actually is. It was on paper, it's the P5 plus one had a deal, the plus one being Germany, with Iran about their nuclear enrichment. And how much they're allowed to enrich, and then how bad the sanctions are going to be. And as you said, the sanctions are pretty much unchanged. They lifted $7 billion, which sounds like a big number. But it really, if you look at it before the sanctions were in place, they're losing about $5 billion per month, which means they're going to lose over $30 billion over the interim plan since it started. So they're still way in the negative. But it's better than nothing. And as for the uranium enrichment, they've had to drop that dramatically. But that doesn't really matter to Iran, because they were never aiming to build a nuclear weapon to begin with. That was just something to have so they would have leverage for something to bargain with.
You're very, very right as well. And if they were to build a nuclear weapon, I mean, it would make them more of a target than anything else. But how do you view what's really going on? Because you can listen to Obama and you can kind of say that, oh, maybe this is, he's finally sort of relaxing a little bit. He's not so concerned with destroying Iran, and oh, these talks are wonderful. But for me, at least, I don't really see any change in the overall policy of the United States, which is to overthrow the ruling government in Iran. So is this really just sort of a kind of a cosmetic sort of a approach to all of this?
Well, I think maybe the U.S. prefers Rouhani over some of the other possibilities in Iran. So they're willing to work with him more than they were, let's say, the previous, the president, Ahmadinejad. They hated him. And there are others that are more threatening to the U.S., but I don't think it's Obama. And I'm not a fan of Barack Obama, but it's not him that's warming up. It's reality. It's the generals who, as evil as they are not completely insane, and they understand that a hot war with Iran, like we had in Iraq, would be devastating not only to the U.S. but the entire world. Now, Saudi Arabia and Israel don't care. because it's them who get sent in to die, and they aren't the ones who have to sacrifice. But America cannot survive another war. And I don't mean that they would lose it physically, militarily, but economically they would be destroyed. And so the generals, the realists, are saying, look, this is not an option. So reality is forcing Obama to walk a tightrope, because he's got all the pressure from the Israeli lobby on one hand, who owns the Senate, and they're pressuring Obama. And then, but on the other side, what's he supposed to do? He can't bomb Iran. He can't have in sanctions just indefinitely. I mean, they really haven't lifted them anyway. So he has to throw him a bone, and that's all he's doing.
And of course, too, many of these sanctions are not enforced by the president, but enforced by Congress. So there's only so much that he can really do. And we just saw the other day various members of the Senate and the Congress trying to increase the sanctions I believe even Rand Paul was on the floor talking about how this was, we needed to do this. This was a good thing.
Well, that's a sad thing too, because the agreement was specifically that they wouldn't do that. But what it actually said is there can't be any new sanctions. So with the U.S. is the way they play with words is, well, they're not new. We're just expanding on the originals.
Yeah. And I found it really funny how, you know, they came to this agreement that they wouldn't increase the sanctions, and you know, you could sort of see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And then, you know, within a few days of that, there were new sanctions that were being handed out. And people sort of course, will sort of ignore that and will look at every little thing that Iran does wrong. So, you know, people were waiting for them to screw up on enrichment or this or that. But for the most part, it seems as if they are trying their hardest, and America continually just lies about it.
Well, it was like the after the wedding bombing in Yemen, the Yemen parliament came out and banned drones. And less than a month later, the U.S. is drone bombing farmers again anyway. And the P5+1 deal on sanctions didn't even last a single month either before the U.S. started playing around. However, in response to that, which was equally schoolboyish level of maturity, was Russia and China said, okay, we can't buy oil monetarily with cash or gold or anything. But what they did is they said, okay, Russia sends in X amount of engineers to do some work in exchange for oil, but they didn't buy it. So, you know, there's just lots of ways to do that. And whenever you put sanctions on anything anywhere, you're creating a massive black market. And that there are a lot of people who benefit from that as well.
Especially the regimes in which that are trying to be ousted out. Obviously, intense sanctions only empowers the central government there, and even people that might be against the government in Iran are inevitably going to rely on them for everything now. So, Saddam Hussein or Fidel Castro, it ultimately doesn't really, you know, it just hurts the average person, but not the people at the very top.
Well, just in our lifetime, or in my lifetime anyway, you can look at the first embargo against Iran, and what happened was people like Pincus Green and Mark Rich made a killing by buying things for pennies on the dollar, since, you know, Iran couldn't sell to anybody else. They're not selling to Israel, not the government, but individuals who bought up the oil and then turned around and sold it to the people who wanted to buy it anyway, but they weren't buying it from Iran, they were buying it from Mark Rich. And so he went in and made all these deals, and then we found out later that a lot of the profits from these things were being used in Iran-Contra. So they were selling the illegal oil, which was supposed to be embargoed, as well as guns and drugs, which is typical, to pay the Contras to kill Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and from there on with all the rest of it. But you had these, you know, individual mafia types, you know, Boris Berezovsky, who died last year, he was the senpai, we'd say, for Mark Rich or his protege. Light's not really shined on these guys. And they're not intelligence. Mark Rich was on Interpol's most wanted list. Bill Clinton gave him a pardon his last day in office. but his lawyer, of course, was Louis Libby, who ended up being Cheney's chief of staff. Who got pardoned by Bush. So, that's how it works.
Yeah, the connections and the nepotism that goes on.
But anybody hung up on this left and right stuff, I mean, there's a nice clear example of it. It doesn't really matter.
Right, exactly. What's Ryan, what is your take on Iran being asked to go to the Geneva II conference in Switzerland right now? Because I saw it as obviously... there are certain factions that do believe that Iran could be, very instrumental in bringing about some sort of an end to this. But it seems that every time it's brought up, the so-called Syrian National Council goes into a hissy fit over this. And I was wondering, I sort of started to interpret this a little bit as a simple way to continue the conflict without any sort of a real deal being made. You just, you know, you let Iran come, and then ultimately the SNC won't, you know, show up, and they'll just continue on to keep fighting. But I'd like to see what your take on that is.
I have a pretty similar view. I mean, they have to invite them. They got it. They've had the whole non-aligned movement, and they have, you know, Russia and China and other major players that say you can't have such an ordeal with Syria and not have Iran, at least at the table, even though they plan on just ignoring them, they have to at least be there. And so it helps him and his base to say, look, see, we're moving forward slightly. But as far as how much they're going to listen to him, how much do they ever listen to anybody? I mean, the whole Security Council, you think about it, it's like, yes, the rest of you plebs are here, but, you know, we're the votes that matter. So, But, I mean, Syria, of course, is part of the old Oded Yinan plan. I mean, that's really obvious now. I was saying it before it even started. I was saying it back in 2003 when Judith Miller was lying and saying, I think Iraq snuck their WMDs over to Syria, which was ridiculous. And she quoted, of course, Pearl Wolfowitz and Israeli security forces. You couldn't get more any worse than that. But it took them longer than I thought. So I was wrong on the timeline, but I was right in what they're going to do. And they're doing it now, and people should read Oded Yinan. I mean, more than the clean break papers or any of that, the original plan from the Israeli strategist, Oded, O-D-E-D, Yinan, Y-I-N-O-N. Check that out, folks.
Absolutely. All of that information is out there, and they don't really hide it. They just assume that most people aren't really going to pay attention. But
at the time, didn't have to, because he wrote it in the 80s and there was no internet. I mean, how do you get hold of a policy paper, even know it's there? It was very hard back then to know. But now, not you just much less of an excuse, because you can just Google it up and get it. But you have to know what to Google, at least. You know, you have to know what to look for. But at least now you're able to look for things. So it's much, much harder for them to hide things now than it was in the past. But when they used to do things in the 80s so openly and brazenly, because they knew that nobody's going to call them out on it. But now they're regretting it, because all of that stuff is still out there, and now we have access to it.
And it's very easy to point to this now and to say, you know, look, this is really actually playing out the way that they wanted it to.
Oh, yeah. If you read it, you would think someone wrote it like last year. I mean, it is just A, B, C to Z. I mean, everything he asked for, there's what they're doing.
Well, maybe you could expand a little bit about that. I'm not sure if my listeners are totally up to speed on that, but could you break down what's in that paper?
Sure. I mean, it's a long paper. I'll give you the bullet point version. One thing he said is, okay, step one, we got to remove Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and we're going to divide Iraq into sectarian violence and sections. We'll have a Kurdistan in the north, and we're going to have a Shiite region in the capital, and then Sunnis in the south, which is exactly what happened, and all of them fighting with each other, and they also killed Saddam. And he said, you know, the pretexts that we could use are this, and this, and they cited weapons of mass destruction and ethnic cleansing of Kurds and so on, which, of course, the whole reason so many Kurds are in northern Iraq is because in 96 and 97, when Turkey was ethnically cleansing the Kurds in Turkey, which the U.S. supported, they were the second highest aid recipient both years, of course, the number one being Israel. But usually it's Egypt. But those 2 years, it was the Turks, because they were pushing the Kurds into northern Iraq. And so the whole reason there's such a large population of them there is because the U.S. supported the Turkish ethnic cleansing of Kurds. But then all of a sudden, when it happens in Iraq, and it wasn't ethnic cleansing in Iraq, but Kurds were killed in Iraq, but the U.S. suddenly decided to care about the Kurds in 2002 and 2003, who they had already helped in butchering, you know, just as an excuse to say, oh, we're going to go liberate the Kurds. That was one of the, you know, the bones thrown to the left as a kind of humanitarian pretext, along since the weapons didn't work and the anthrax lies and many other lies didn't work. They use the Kurdish angle, which they don't care about the Kurds.
No. no one seems to care about the Kurds, unfortunately.
The public didn't even know what that even means. Like, who are they? They didn't know. I mean, the Kurds do, you know, they don't have autonomy. They're like the Tuareg or the Palestinians or many groups in Africa or in the Middle East but I mean, I personally don't think you should have special rights or rights based on, you know, your version of religion or whatever. And I think the concept of ethnicities are kind of silly. You should have rights because you're a person. But, you know, that's too adult for most people.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we could talk about the Middle East and the goings on there without discussing the death of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. I was just completely floored. I mean, I guess I shouldn't have really been surprised, but when he died, be it on Twitter or anywhere in internet newspapers, there were these glowing talk of, oh, he was the peacemaker. He reached out to the Palestinians. He did this and that. And I was actually a little bit surprised, only in that it's just he's was such a right-wing psycho. And it's a little hard to actually think that a former military commander in Israel could really be reaching out to the Palestinians. But
he reached for them.
yes, he did. Yeah, and everything that they owned.
Yeah, I was absolutely disgusted at the whitewashing of Ariel Sharon. Mm. I mean, he's worse than Netanyahu. And he's on par with Lieberman. And actually, as far as what he got done, he's probably the worst person. I mean, when he died, I just said cheers. But when I started reading the whitewashing, which I anticipated, I mean, it doesn't matter. I made a video once saying, you know, they could get up on stage and eat a baby and people would make excuses for it. But this guy, I mean, can I just tell you some of the stuff he did? I mean,
please. Let's dive into the legacy of Ariel Sharon.
Because, okay, I want to say before he was prime minister, because I think once he became prime minister from then on, he's more of a light. He's in the spotlight more, and people paid attention to it more. But I would tell you about early Sharon and some of the things he did. One, he started his career in the Haganah terrorist group, which is kind of a paramilitary group before Israel was Israel, and that just sort of got absorbed into the official government after the first war. And so he got put in charge of this thing called Unit 101. And they went into the El Berg refugee camp, which is in southern part of Gaza, and they just started slaughtering civilians. And this is how they did. They had an army, and they're not fighting an army. They're fighting just people, you know, sleeping in their houses. They started throwing bombs through their windows and just killed whole families while they were sleeping. And when people ran out of their houses, they gunned them down. All right, this is that right there. I'm going to name a lot more, but that already, you're already a war criminal and a psychopath, and you're murdering families with your army. With his unit. And, you know, they all were doing this, but it's ethnic cleansing. But then he attacked the Jordanian village of Kibya. The Zionists blew up 45 houses. It just made him rubble. And, again, murdered whole families. Two-thirds of them were women and children. Although it's not that, like, men are less valuable. But I do think, you know, pointing out how many were children, it matters to me. But they're all, I mean, they're all just... They didn't do anything wrong other than being Palestinian. And they just destroyed 45 houses and they blew up all these people. They blew up the school. They blew up the reservoir. Can you imagine this today? Can you imagine someone in Iran going into a village and just bombing 45 houses and murdering a bunch of kids and blowing up a school? And can you imagine that happening anywhere? Besides Israel?
Yeah, you would never hear the end of it from here. It would be, no, I mean, just no one could get away with it, essentially. But for several different reasons, Israel manages to get away with this.
Yeah, I mean, today they bulldoze down houses, but they make the people get out of them first most of the time.
Right. Oh, yeah,
and
that's nice.
They demolish the house, and someone has to live as a refugee, and they're homeless, and they steal property, and they burn farms and stuff. But they don't actually just go in the middle of the night and just start bombing houses with the people inside of them. You know, I mean, they can't get away with that unless they make it a war. Yeah. But I mean, Sharon was doing this routinely, and then he took his artillery and he shot up all the adjacent villages. And this is just what he does. And instead of going to jail or anything, he got promoted.
That always seems to be in any government, the more horrible things you do, the more you get elevated to higher and higher levels of power.
Well, that's what happened. You've seen my film. That's what happened with Richard Blee and all the people who screwed up on 9/11. They all got promoted.
Yeah. And Ariel Sharon, correct me if I'm wrong, but was involved in Lebanon in the massacre of the Christian, not the Christian village, but he helped to orchestrate a huge massacre in cooperation with the Christian militants. Is that right?
Oh, well, he did that in Lebanon and Egypt. Mm. I mean, okay, so his Unit 101, it got sort of upgraded into the paratrooper corps for the Israeli army, and he's made a commander, and he's a commander in the IDF, which is called the Israeli Defense Force, but I mean, it's right. it's offense. It's like when they attacked Lebanon last time, they called it a preemptive war. I mean, how is it preemptive? Oh, they're dead. Well, they're dead in a preemptive fashion, you know?
It's the wordplay of war lately has just reached unprecedented levels with the collateral damage and kinetic force and all of these things.
Oh, that's the best one. It's not, we're not. Yeah. It's kinetic military action. Well, isn't action and kinetic already redundant? And I mean, come on.
it's just euphemisms for butchering people, essentially.
Yeah, slaughtering people. And this is what it is, not even army versus army. This is just going in and blowing people up while they're in their houses. And he did that in Bundras, and he did it in Shukba. He demolished those places too. And then, as I said, he gets in the paratrooper corps. And he's made the brigade commander, and they murdered another 83 people in Kalkilia, which is in the West Bank, or was. And then during the 1956 war with Egypt, which I think is kind of the really, really forgotten war. Like, people talk about the Koreas. And a lot of people talk about 67 or Yom Kippur or the original war, but not 56. And that was started by a false flag. That was Operation Susanna that got that going. I mean, a lot of people talk about the Levon affair, but I don't like naming it that, because Pincus Levon, the defense minister, he's actually set up. Not that he was a great person, but he wasn't responsible for it. It was Ben-Gurion's goons and Ben-Gvir that, anyway. Sharon is actually on the ground, and he had, I don't remember how many, hundreds, though, of Egyptian POWs murdered on three separate occasions, and he dumped them all of the dead prisoners into mass graves. And nothing, you know, he gets promoted again. So from there, he climbed a ladder, and now he's an IDF commander. And then he cemented his relationship with a bunch of Jewish organized crime figures, like, you know, Mayor Lansky, who was, you know, partners with Luck Luciano in New York. And then, of course, the Russian mob bosses, and who are Jewish mafia in Russia, really. And then he creates this thing called the Rimon Union. And this is really... really, like, even if it can get worse, it does. And this is a lot like the U.S.'s death squads in El Salvador. They had a, or in Vietnam for that matter, it was a civilian assassination program. So, actually, it's just like the CIA's Operation Phoenix. If people are familiar with Operation Phoenix,
yes, yes,
they did. Is yeah, that's the real dirty wars that Jeremy Scahill refuses to get into. But yeah. I'm not gonna. We can talk about
let's not go into Jeremy Scahill. too much to focus on there.
But one guy, Benny Golan, he's a former member of the Rimon unit, and he had his big confession, and he said, he dressed up as Arabs and conducted terrorist attacks on even Israeli Jewish targets to justify retaliation. And we saw that in Iraq, too, you know, with the British dressed up as Arabs attacking a wedding to get Sunnis and Shiites fighting with each other, which is pretty easy to do. And, you know, they got caught and they were thrown in jail, and the British army went in with tanks and actually smashed the wall of the jail down to get them out. They had wigs on and everything. I mean, this was Operation Phoenix, or this, that's how it really started. But I'd say this might have been before Operation. Yeah, this is before Operation Phoenix. So the Israelis actually put it all down first. Who knows who designed it? Because they always work together. But because the CIA's the chief at that time was a complete Zionist, and that's another tangent. But we can get into him later. But yeah, he just went around with Rimon unit and slaughtered Arabs, civilians, assassinated, and created false flags, and. He went in the Gaza Strip and he bulldozed down 100 homes at Beach Camp. And the reason he did it is because this was a place where they had sort of narrow streets. And he just went in, they went in and marked the houses with red paint. And then anything with a red X on it, or circle or whatever they sprayed on there, he probably put Stars of David on there. And they just went in and smashed them with bulldozers so that he could make a wide enough canal to bring in his heavy artillery and tanks and armored cars and things so that he could... literally have a police state and lock them down in Beach Camp in Gaza. I mean, 100 houses, and they just taking their stuff and throw it out on the street, and no news coverage of this. Not in the U.S. anyway. I mean, I'm sure it's in some papers and things, but not in a U.S. paper, not on U.S. TV. Now, flip that around. Imagine somebody went in and bulldozed down 100 Israeli homes and then brought in tanks and armored cars, and no way. There's no way that could happen. But if you're Palestinian, you might as well have been a Native American from the 1800s or something. You're not a human.
And yeah, and you know, we're supposed to laud this man with praise and whatnot at the hour of his death. And it's just so he really is just the complete opposite of everything that is good or right in this world.
He got promoted again after that, and he became the defense minister, and he helped demolish over 2,000 Palestinian homes. And then he got promoted again, and he becomes the prime minister. And then we all know what he did from there and what he did in Lebanon and his racial colonization into the West Bank and Gaza Strip. It's total ethnic cleaning. It's a racist state. I mean, it's not even apartheid. It's worse. And it's not even... It's kind of... they're colonizing them, but not really. Because usually a colony... If you look at the old, like, European colonization, most of the time, they come in and they export their people, you know, their people, and kind of squat on some land somewhere and exploit the population for resources or something. But this is worse than that. They don't want to use the Palestinians. They want them gone, dead. I mean, they want their water. They don't care about them at all. Put them in a prison camp, which is what Gaza is, and they want them dead. So it's much more akin to maybe the colonization of American Indians or briefly some of the Nazi occupations, but yeah, they just want them gone. And they praise this man. I mean, he was the prime minister. He just kept getting one promotion after another for slaughtering people.
Oh yeah, and he also, I mean, in many ways, helped to cement this the sort of like ultra right wing Zionist government that we see right now. You know, definitely helped to bolster their popularity while he formed his own party. I mean, essentially, you know, Netanyahu and some of the other psychopaths, like you mentioned, Lieberman, just had to simply, you know, go even beyond that to win votes. Is Ariel Sharon at all implicated in some of the nuclear smuggling? I know that you've touched on this before in your podcast. And I know that Netanyahu has been outed as being involved in this with the nuclear triggers. But was Ariel Sharon, to your knowledge, ever associated with this?
Well, when they were killing POWs in Egypt, he was with Rafael Edenton, who we know met... with the folks at NUMEC where they were stealing this stuff. So Zalman Shapiro and Rafael Edenton were meeting in NUMEC, Pennsylvania, where they were procuring a lot of this uranium. Now, Netanyahu's side of it was more through Heli Trading Company, which was set up by Anan Milchan, the producer for JFK, who's he owns Channel 10 in Israel, which recently had Clint Greenwald on there talking about Pollard. Anyway,
very interesting. Yeah, I was not sure what to make.
I don't have any concrete evidence of Sharon being part of the nuclear smuggling. He's too busy murdering Egyptians and Palestinians and things. But I know all the people around him were involved in it. So maybe you know, I know he was with Edenton, and I know that Netanyahu was. So I don't know. He's not really bright enough to be part of that. I mean, Ariel Sharon, it was not a clever man by any means. He was just a slaughterer. I mean, he's the butcher. They call him the butcher. That's exactly what his role was and, you know, what he could do. However, he did have close relationships with a lot of these mob guys and a lot of the mafia guys. They had overlapping interests. They didn't really care if Israel got a bomb or not, but they'll do whatever for money, so... See that?
Oh yeah, yeah. What Ryan? Quickly, what was your take on Glenn Greenwald talking about Jonathan Pollard? This is something that I've talked about not on the show but on the blog a little bit. Pollard is just such a bizarre character, and I really could not understand why Glenn Greenwald was even bringing him up and talking about his release and somehow comparing him to Edward Snowden. I found all of that to be a bit odd, especially given
Greenwald's... The host brought it up, but I think the host on the TV is the one that brought it up. And he didn't say he should be released, but he said it's the same. He put it on par with. He said, well, I don't see why we care about the Israelis spying on the U.S. when the U.S. spies on Israel. He said it like that. And my take on that is like, Well, instead of neither one being wrong, how about they're both wrong? You know, like, why would you say it's, oh, well, the U.S. is spying on Israel, so it's okay if Israel spies on the U.S.? I would say, no, it's wrong for either one of them to spy on each other. How about that? You know, And he wasn't just spying. I mean, Jonathan Pollard did so much damage to the U.S. and it just screwed up Middle Eastern policy forever. The U.S. is not stealing uranium or technology from Israel. They don't have anything to steal. They're getting, it's the other way around. The U.S. is the one with the technology and the supplies, and Israel's the one stealing it. And that's what they did. And they did it in secret. And the last person to ever challenge him on it was the Kennedys. Of course, Robert Kennedy said, you got 72 hours to register all the ZOA and the American Zionist Council and then AIPAC as foreign agents. And we want to inspect the Mona, which is where the nukes are. And Mordecai Vanunu proved that. And there's pictures of it. And of course, Mordecai Vanunu, the first thing he said when he got out of jail is the Israelis had Kennedy killed. But they're having this war. And this is, of course, whitewashed. They blame everything on the CIA or whatever. There's a zillion theories. But all I got to say is, Robert got killed by a Palestinian, so to speak. Mm. And if you look at who benefited, if you want to say the CIA did it because they wanted to go into Cuba or whatever, doesn't make a lot of sense because Johnson was in power and didn't go back into Cuba. But one thing he did do is send the USS Liberty in to get destroyed, and he helped the Israelis in the 1967 war, and he was sleeping with Matilda Krim, an Ergun terrorist. He was actually in bed with her in the White House the day the 1967 war broke out.
The history there is very fascinating and very bizarre, and it gets to such an intertwined level that at times it seems it's almost impossible to sort of separate Israel and the United States. They've become this one very incestuous, behemoth type force of nature.
Well, it's hard to separate the CIA and the Mossad at that time.
Yes, yes.
And even prior to that, the Dulles brothers, but one in the State Department, one in the CIA, and they were involved with Operation Ajax in Iran, and they were involved in the Suez Crisis in Egypt, hand in glove with the Mossad. But Eisenhower said no; he put a kibosh on the Levant affair and the rest of it because, one, it was him and C.D. Jackson that helped, let's just say, inflate some of the things from World War II. And he knew better, and he said, we're going to have UN peacekeepers here for 10 years. And that was from 1957 until 1967. And weeks after they were removed, Israel starts the 1967 war. But the only thing that had a buffer on that at all was for the peace agreement after the 1956 war was Eisenhower coming in and saying, we're going to police this area. And the moment the Egyptians got out of Palestine, Israel moved in to Gaza, and then they attacked all of it.
For people that don't know about the USS Liberty, that is another one of these very bizarre, interesting false flag attacks.
Yeah, that was the same war too. War.
Yeah, and was essentially just to try and force America's hand.
Well, they wanted him to attack Egypt. I mean, Israel initially said that Egyptians had attacked the United States. And then they had to backpedal from that lie to saying, oh, okay, well, we attacked the ship, but we thought it was an Egyptian boat, which is another lie. And it was very see-through. And all the survivors unanimously agree. No, the Israelis knew we were American, a big flag. We hailed them, et cetera. And one of the pilots actually didn't fire, refused to shoot or anything. But the rest of them did. And they strafed it for 3 hours in unmarked planes. You know, why do you attack a ship in an unmarked plane? There's only one reason to do that. But they failed to sink it. And had Johnson saying, I want the damn thing on the bottom of the ocean, you know, and he did nothing about it, of course.
Yes.
I mean, he was their man. He's Israel's man. And they knew that. That's why he was there.
Yeah. And, for anyone that wants a little bit more background on this, I know, I believe you've spoken with Grant Smith before, and he has a tremendously good book called Divert, which goes into the nuclear diversion program and fills in a lot of the holes here. And he makes a lot of very fascinating connections between how Israel actually got the nuclear material and a lot of detail, too, about Johnson's whole role in this.
Well, Grant Smith is the man on the NUMEX scandal, as well as even a lot of the surplus World War II weapons that were coming from, like Charlie Winters and these guys. And none of them getting in any trouble or anything, but Grant's gone through meticulously and detailed that whole narrative. And then for some more on on Johnson in Israel, you can look up my interview with Grant, my interview with Jeff Gates, and one with Jeff Blankfort. And then in a couple days, I'll be interviewing Michael Piper, and I'm sure we'll talk about that too.
Mm. Well, Ryan, I know that you've got a lot of other things to do today, but before we wrap this up, please tell everybody where they can go to listen to your podcast, a little bit about your work, about your films as well. I know you have a new film right now that I think is available on YouTube. And of course, the links to these will all be available. And I would highly, highly recommend your film, War by Deception, which is just a really, really fascinating, one of the best films on 9/11 truth. But please, Ryan, tell everybody a little bit about that.
Gilad Osman was just in Japan, and I had a whole table of people telling him to watch War by Deception, because when it comes to 9/11, there is so much, let's just say, baloney out there on it, that unless you started looking from the beginning, just forget about it. Because if you try and Google it up now, there's just a sea of sensationalism and just cockamamie baloney.
Disinfo. And
disinformation, you know, Jonestown stuff, and it ranges, you know, people still think a missile at the Pentagon. I mean, you just need your head examined. Yeah. But if you want some factual and verifiable information, it is a long film, but War by Deception's definitely the way to go. And I made a kind of film before that. My new film is called Decades of Deception, and that's 60 years of CIA and some Assad and some MI6, basically intelligence agencies and their evil things they do. And it's conspiracies, and it's not just Iran-Contra and Operation Phoenix, like I mentioned today. I start from the Korean War on, and I did a nice timeline, and it jumps, you know, what's going on in Cuba, what was going on in Iran, what was going on in Egypt, and showing all these different programs all the way through Operation Washtub, Operation Gladio, just going on and on through 60 years of covert operations. So at the end of it, if you're in denial of conspiracy, because that's what a covert operation is.
Oh, yeah.
That's all that is. I mean, that's a conspiracy. It would a bunch of people who lie to you, who do something like, you know, murder a bunch of people, which is, you know, otherwise would be illegal. And they'd try to do it in secret. And it could be the Gulf of Tonkin. It could be, and it ends on 9/11. Because it's just too big of a subject. But I did get into the Kennedys in the film, and I'm going to be doing a film just on the Kennedys next. But it just sort of bleeds in. So if you watch Decades of Deception and it ends on 9/11, and then you just watch War by Deception, which is specifically about 9/11 and the anthrax attack and the lead up to the war in Iraq, those three events, because they're all related.
Yeah, and that's another just awesome part about the whole film, is that you just go through all of that, you know, if the war in Iraq is fake and the anthrax is fake, I mean, how could 9/11 be real, or at least the version of events that we've been told?
Well, even better. I mean, the anthrax lie, they tried to say that Mohammed Atta met senior Iraqi officials in Prague where they gave him anthrax. Of course, there wasn't a meeting in Prague. Mohammed Atta didn't have anthrax and neither did Iraq. But supposedly the Israeli security forces witnessed this. And that went through Gary Schmidt and James Woolsey and Kagan and Crystal and all the neocons, and PNAC published this junk. And Dick Cheney gets up there with Tim Russert and says it. And then Connie Lee Rice says it. And it's just what Karl Rove called, you know, the message force multipliers, to go in and say this lie over and over and over again. The anthrax notes say death to America, death to Israel. They're sent from the same location as the hijacker cells, so somebody knew where to send them from. But then it turned out it was genetically traced back to the United States, and there was no meeting in Prague. So how did they witness a transfer of anthrax in a place that didn't happen? But that's how they connected Iraq to 9/11. They said that Iraqis were meeting with a 9/11 hijacker, but they weren't. But you know who was living next door to the Mohammed Atta? The Israeli Mossad.
Oh, yeah. And just in the film, you go through, you give so much information that just seems to be put into the memory hole. The whole the truck bombs on the George Washington Bridge. I mean, this was something that
that's the thing. I'm glad you said that, too, because they don't talk about the truck bombs on the bridge. Some people talk about the five dancing Israelis, and actually it was three, not five. Five were arrested in the van later. But anyway, what's odd, too, is when they went on Israeli talk show later, both the Kreuzberg brothers were in the audience. However, I know from I have the police reports that they were actually in the photos as the dancing, as part of the dancing group. But Momari is up there on stage with Yaron Schmel and Oded Elner, and Elner and Momari weren't even there. So they didn't even want you to know that. And that was, no one looked at that critically because they didn't have their names. But even though it's redacted in the police report, you can look at the black space and count the letters and you still know who's who. It was pretty easy to do. And then I have reports from them when they passed the video off to the White Glove, which is a strip joint that they were, they were using. And the Aero Trucks and Urban Moving Systems and then Dominic Suter and all that. You just got to watch the film. But I think I'm going to have like an hour long extra here sometime this year for War by Deception, because I've gotten into some other things with P-TECH and some more Israeli, more condemning facts when the Israelis. It's kind of kicking a dead horse, but I feel like it all needs to be out there.
Yes, yes.
No one talks about any of that stuff.
Well, yeah, you're an anti-Semite if you do that.
Oh, good. I mean, they had passes to the... Five people got arrested who had passes to the World Trade Center. They burned Catherine Smith to death. There was Dinko Mechanical. I mean, it's just on and on. But it's all, Illuminati, Bavarian death cults, and... Building 7 fell too fast. Like, okay. It doesn't tell you what happened. It tells you what did not happen. It's just a path to nowhere.
But absolutely. And you go into that in the film as well. I mean, you dissect people like Loose Change and a lot of the kind of nonsense that is out there.
That film was horrible. That was the worst 9/11 film ever. And it got promoted by all the known charlatans. Jonestown, if it comes to Fetzer, who doesn't believe there are any planes at all, he's into that dustification nonsense and all that. And he blames Kennedy's killing on his wife. I mean, he thinks no one died at Sandy Hook. And so these people, how do we even, why do we even know who they are? You know who they are. I know who they are. Because they get springboarded by Jonestown. And he is he's their best asset. And I mean that in a literal sense. He's their best asset. And the other kooks on the other side are the veterans today, people that just blame everything on the Jews. And which happens, they say all this all the time. So I bring up Israeli role in anything and they go, oh, you're one of them anti-Semitic, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, last time I checked, Israel's a country and I'm as able to criticize them as I do Saudi Arabia or North Korea. And it doesn't mean I hate Arabs or Asians. I live in Japan even. But when you criticize Israel, they're like, what, do you hate Jews? No, I don't hate Jews. I hate a state that ethnically cleanses its neighbors. I mean, why wouldn't you? But yeah. But you asked me before. Podcasts are on ancreport.com. And then from that page on the top, there's links to the forum and my Twitter and Facebook and all the rest of it. And then on YouTube, it's Rise 2 Cents, which is a horrible name. But at the time, I had 12 people following me. I didn't know I was going to be on television. I didn't know I was going to be doing radio interviews. And I just was putting like a little pun in there for like Thomas Paine, 2 cents.
Yeah, yeah.
And I spelled sense with an S, as in like sensei. It was like, it was a very clever pun, but because it was this to me,
So, and once you change that, once you make that name on YouTube, that's it. There's no way to alter that. I've run into the same problem with my channel. It's not the name that I wanted anymore.
But I think it's the first time I've explained the name anywhere. So you get that for your viewers.
All right. Well, very good. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show. We'd love to have you back on and talk again.
Hey, I'd love to come on when Bibi dies or when Kissinger dies. Or
yes, absolutely. Maybe we can have a regular eulogy for horrible war criminals when they die.
I think that would be awesome.
Ryan, thank you so much.
All right, I got to meet a guy from London here, so I'll come back on anytime. It doesn't have to be when a neocon dies, but definitely when one kicks the bucket. They should not get away with the whitewashing. They should not be exonerated. People should know about their crimes. For Schroen, I personally think they ought to sell tickets and maybe like some little like bowling shoes to wear to go pee on his grave.
All right, everybody, that was Ryan Dawson from Anti-Neocon.